Some estimated 25 million ash trees have been killed primarily in southeast Michigan, and in 2002 the causal agent was determined to be the emerald ash borer, Gryllus planipennis, exotic beetle native to East Asia. And it behaves generally like a typical buprestid, feeding under the bark on the xylem-phloem interface, girdling the trees, disrupting the flow of nutrients and water. And all the major ash species in North America that it's encountered so far have proven to be susceptible to one degree or another. It kills trees fairly rapidly, at least after symptoms become visible, and it colonizes trees of every size that's physically big enough to house a buprestid, basically from 1 inch up. As I said, it behaves like a typical buprestid, except for one key thing, and that is that it's attacking and killing healthy trees as well as stress trees. So it's created a wood borer outbreak, a buprestid outbreak of unprecedented intensity in southeast Michigan. And here's an example. This isn't a bark beetle damage. There's no evidence of any kind of aggregation pheromone. This kind of mass attack is a result of individual oviposition decisions by individual females. And so they're overwhelming and killing the trees quite quickly. This map shows the known distribution of emerald ash borer, at least as we know it today, and the main infestation is concentrated here in southeast Michigan and Windsor. As I said, it's a lot redder than this. They're not filling in the map there anymore. That wave of mortality is spreading. The wave of tree mortality is spreading out about 15 miles a year, more or less, in all directions. And then you see isolated outlier infestations in Illinois, Indiana, throughout Ohio, West Virginia, and Maryland as a result of artificial movement by human activity. I want to talk a little bit about research that our group has been doing and our collaborators on a couple things. One is that we're looking at patterns of ash mortality in the forests of southeast Michigan and ecological impacts of subsequent gap formation. And we're also looking at chemical ecology of the host-insect interaction from a co-evolutionary standpoint, with the idea of trying to inform a breeding program for resistance. This is the distribution of the major ash species in eastern North America, so you can see that we're dealing with a continental spread as the insect continues to move through North America. I just want to back up for a second if I can. Yep. And draw your attention to a poster that Nate Siegert is going to present tomorrow, I believe, Tuesday, where he's done some really fascinating dendrochronology work in Dub McCullough's lab and with their colleagues to reconstruct the history of the establishment and spread of emerald ash borer in southeast Michigan. And it's providing some really interesting insights, and so you might want to check that out. In Ohio, it's going to be a really big deal because ash is such an important component of the forest in Ohio, and these are some FIA data, but the Ohio Department of Natural Resources estimates that about 10% of the canopy cover in Ohio's forest is ash, and about a third of Ohio is very heavily forested, about two-thirds is urban and agricultural. So we've been interested in what is going to be the impact of this ash. It's fairly uniformly distributed. You don't find ash stands. Ash exists in a very mixed deciduous forest component, and you get scattered gap forming throughout the forest as these trees are killed. An example of a gap in one of our forest sites. Some of our objectives have been to ask whether forest composition affects susceptibility to invasion. Are all forests equally susceptible? What are patterns and rates of ash mortality? How fast are these forests being killed? How fast is ash declining? Successional patterns, effects on understory species and also on exotic plant. Ash regeneration, seedling dynamics, seed bank dynamics. Is ash going to return? Will EAB take it out if it does? And as I said, the spread of invasive plants moving from the forest edges into these gaps as it hopscotches into the forest. The work that we're doing is in the Huron River watershed of southeast Michigan, and this is there's a remarkable amount of forest actually in southeast Michigan. Of course, it's embedded in a highly urbanized matrix, but there's a large number of natural areas, state game areas, state recreation areas with large tracts of forest in this area. And we're working in these sites. We've established 30 stands. Within each of these stands, we've established a transect consisting of three plots, each a tenth of a hectare or quarter acre in size. And we've been looking at this across a moisture gradient and also an ash species gradient consisting of white ash on xeric upland sites to green ash on riparian sites and black ash in the more swampy and seasonally flooded lowlands. And I just want to point out this rating scale because I'm going to show some data based on this in terms of how we're quantifying ash decline and mortality on a scale of 1 to 5, with 1 being no evidence of decline and 5 being a dead tree. This is some work that some graduate students and postdocs have done. Anne Marie Smith, a graduate student, Kamal Gandhi, a postdoc, have been looking at patterns of mortality and decline. And what you see is initially black ash was declining a little bit faster than green and white. And after a couple years, all three species are declining about the same speed. But their average tree is about right here, which corresponds with the average ash tree in these forests being a little bit closer to this than to this. So the trees are declining quite rapidly. Mortality is extremely comprehensive and efficient. We found no relationship, Annie found no relationship between density of ash and decline, and this line continues to elevate. You'll see some more data on that in just a second. Looking at ash density across a fairly wide range, we're seeing no relationship with ash density and EAB. We have data that directly relates this pattern of decline to emerald ash borer infestations as well. No relationship to any of these other variables either. Basal area, relative dominance of ash, density of ash, stand density, stand basal area, no any measure of species diversity. So this really suggests that there's very limited potential for silvicultural options to prevent infestation or invasion and to limit mortality once invasion begins. In fact, the only pattern that we've been able to document is that relationship between percent mortality of ash and distance from the putative epicenter, which I think Nate Siegert's work has pretty much nailed down in Canton Township, Michigan. And so the farther that you move away from the epicenter where EAB initially established, the lower the mortality, a slope of about 2% per kilometer. With each kilometer that you move away, mortality drops 2%. This was in 04 and 05. Looking at Kamal Gandhi revisited Annie's plots in 2006 and found that the pattern stays the same, a 2% drop with each kilometer, but the intercept has jumped up about 30%, a 30% increase in mortality from 1 year to the next. And when Kamal went back in 07, we see now that the slope is no longer significant as the plots are basically all converging on 100% mortality. And this is everything from 1 inch that we're looking at, 1 inch DBH trees up, 100% mortality, extremely efficient killer of these ash trees. So now we're starting to turn our attention to the effects of all these gaps and ecological impacts. And Kamal talked this morning about some of the work she's doing on ground beetles in these gaps, and she's documenting some interesting patterns. We started to look at invasive plants in these gaps and the idea that EAB can facilitate the spread and establishment of invasive plants. So doing that, working with my wife, first grant that we've got together after 12 years of marriage, we're finally solidified as a couple enough to collaborate. Looking at successional trajectories, what we see is in our plots, which were selected because they contain ash, ash is the most common species in the understory. It's also the most common species in the seedling layer. Oak is very common in the overstory, but not in the understory. The most common species in the understory are elm, American and red elm, and maple, red maple, and silver maple in some of the black ash stands. So these stands are going to be converted The great forest ecologist Bert Barnes published an interesting paper back in the late 1960s looking at the effects of Dutch elm disease when it came through these very same forests in southeast Michigan. And he noted that ash was going to be a major beneficiary of Dutch elm disease. And he was very prophetic, and he said, wrote in the discussion of this paper, until a major disturbance comes through and impacts the ash trees. Seedling data, ash is by far the most common seedling. And so this suggests that there's going to be some regeneration and that trees are going to be responding to these gaps and reaching the size that they can become infested. And then the question is, will EAB have died out? Will it come back in and infest these trees? And what impact will these small trees have on population dynamics? These little saplings produce two or three females and they die compared to the thousands of females produced by the large DBH trees. We've also been looking at seed bank dynamics, a collaborative project with Deb McCall and her group at Michigan State. And over the last 3 years, I think we've taken over 700 soil samples, and the number of ash seeds we've found is in the single digits. There is no ash seed bank. There are no dormant ash seeds. The seeds disappear very quickly. So, we're seeing seedlings that are present, saplings that are present. We're about ready to publish a paper that says, dead ash trees produce no seeds. Why are North American ash trees being devastated by a secondary pest, by a buprestid? This is an interesting question that we've been working on as well. And a study that my predecessor at Ohio State, Dave Nielsen, conducted with Franz Birchbohr foretold, I think, the demise of ash. And he established a common garden study at Worcester with seven species of birch trees, highly replicated, three North American species, and bronze birch borer is an endemic North American species. These species have an evolutionary history. These Eurasian species do not. And the results were pretty convincing. The four European and Asian species were overwhelmed and killed. Massive amount of bronze birch borer, huge outbreak, all kinds of beetles flying around in these plots, a major drought in 1988, yet very high survival of the North American species. And so one might conclude from that, where you have no evolutionary history, no resistance, at least a hypothesis. And if Franz Birchbohr were to be introduced to Europe, it would be added to the great phylloxera that Bill Mattson talked about as a second devastating insect pest in Europe. And so they probably hope that they don't get this one. Our research program then, we started in 2003. As soon as we realized this was a buprestid, we figured it was probably the same story in reverse, and that the North American species had no inherent resistance, but we started a research program with these objectives: to identify resistant germplasm in a common garden study, the idea that Asian trees with an evolutionary history are probably resistant, since the pest insect is not a pest in Asia. Working on trying to identify biochemical mechanisms of resistance and resistance genes and markers. Justin Whitehill, PhD student with Enrico Bonello in plant pathology, Ohio State, working on that with Jennifer Cook with the U.S. Forest Service, working with Enrico Bonello and Don Cipollini on biochemistry, chemical ecology, Eric Rebeck, a postdoc with Dave Smitley at Michigan State on the Common Garden study, and Jennifer Cook with the Forest Service has started work on hybridization studies between North American and Asian ashes, with the idea to duplicate some of the successes in the chestnut blight breeding program based on hybridization and backcrossing. So we established this common garden study in 2003, the spring of 2003, just soon after EAB was discovered, with green ash, white ash, Manchurian ash, which has an evolutionary history, and then this hybrid that exists in the nursery industry between North American black ash and Asian Manchurian ash. And the results were pretty much as we suspected they would be: very high survival of Manchurian ash, a little bit of colonization and mortality in the first year, perhaps while the trees were undergoing transplanting stress, no mortality and a little bit of colonization since then, but pretty much 100% mortality, and now it is 100% of the green ash, and also surprisingly the hybrid. But Jennifer Cook, the geneticist with the Forest Service, tells me she's very skeptical this is a true hybrid, and that it's really a black ash, and that the pollen donor, Manchurian ash, may represent or may have been contaminated with black ash pollen. Anyway, so the pattern consistent with what we saw with birch. Here's a Manchurian ash surrounded by North American trees. We've started working on resistance mechanisms, which are not very well understood in deciduous trees to wood borers. But the literature would speculate that this wound-induced periderm or callus tissue is involved in response to larval feeding, and also these induction of phenolics in response to feeding in the phloem tissue may synergistically interact, this chemical and physical induced response. So we're kind of looking at that. This is Don Cipollini injecting a tree with some elicitors. So we're looking at induced responses in the phloem tissue. This is a phenolic profile of the constitutive phloem chemistry of white and green ash. We also are white and Manchurian ash. The red trace is Manchurian ash, and there's a class of phenolic compounds, hydroxycoumarins, present in Manchurian ash that are not present in green ash or white ash. These compounds have been identified, and we published here. Alita Isles, a postdoc, did this work, and we don't know that these are involved in resistance, but surely this is the most distinctive difference we've identified so far, and we're trying to follow that up with bioassays and artificial diets extractions. We've expanded the common garden to include a number of other species, European and other Asian species with the evolutionary history, Fraxinus chinensis, and some European species to kind of get a wider biogeographic range. And we've also started some studies to look at stress effects on resistance, with our prediction being that stress will matter to Manchurian ash, that stress will predispose Manchurian ash to colonization by EAB. But stress won't matter to the North American ash trees since they don't have any resistance to begin with, or it will matter less. So to conclude, what we're seeing is 100% ash mortality in all size classes, and it's just a matter of time before the other plots go to 100%. We see little potential for silvicultural management based on the relationships or lack thereof that we've discovered. We see no seed bank for ash, so the future of ash in southeast Michigan anyway, and probably beyond as it continues to spread, seems extremely perilous. The wild card would be the parasitoids that have been released by APHIS and the Forest Service. Widespread mortality and gap formation we're already seeing are starting to have some pervasive ecological impacts, and we're starting to look at some other things there. Manchurian ash is a source of resistance genes, and host plant resistance in support of breeding. A breeding program is now underway. I'd like to acknowledge the funding sources, in particular the U.S. Forest Service Northern Research Station and APHIS and the ARS, who have funded this work. And also, I'd like to acknowledge students, postdocs, lab group, and collaborators that have been involved in this work with me. And with that, I'll answer any questions if I have time. I'm sorry, lack of appearance?
Lack of appearance of resistance characteristic.
So the question was, do we see any evidence of lack of appearance as a resistance mechanism? And no, I don't. Even in these very, where ash is in very low density, they're finding them and killing the trees.
I've been in Manchuria.
In the common garden, this lack of man. Well, that's kind of an interesting idea. In our common garden, the trees are planted in, you know, pretty close proximity, and we see, I mean, we see them feeding on the foliage, you know, and landing on the trees and so forth. So, but that, you know, that's an interesting idea, I guess. I guess the idea would be that there'd been selection to reduce oviposition. Pardon me? Want to hide. I can't really answer the question. It's interesting, but I can't answer it.
The idea of the co-evolved relationship between the host plant and the beetle, why would the mechanisms that the native trees have for native borers not work against the introduced borer?
All right, so the question is, why would mechanisms of resistance that North American ashes have not worked against emerald ash borer. And one would be that they just lack these specific targeted defenses that are toxic to emerald ash borer. Another major point is that the native borers are cerambycids. The most important ones are cerambycids and cisseids that are feeding in the sapwood and heartwood. And you don't have a major phloem borer. The buprestids of ash are more twig borers and canopy things. So it's kind of a, this phloem feeding on the main trunk is kind of a vacant niche that emerald ash borer has exploited.
Good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.